Well, the word emunah is faith in God, but that refers primarily to your intellectual understanding that God runs the world and nothing happens without Hashem's will and Hashem's desire. But that doesn't necessarily mean emotionally you live that way. In other words, the difference between emunah and bitachon is emunah is primarily in the mind and bitachon is in the heart and the emotions. So bitachon, which literally means security, serenity, trust, is really when you take emunah and you can apply it to your real life. The Brisker Rav used to say that it's easy to have emunah when you have $1 million in the bank. Bitachon is what you have when you have nothing in the bank and you still go on. Now, in terms of the how you acquire it, this is the big challenge of life. How does one acquire it? You know, there are many, many svarim that talk about it, both ancient svarim and modern svarim. The Chovas HaLevavos has a whole chapter called The Gate of Bitachon, which is considered to be a very, very classic and important work. The Chovas HaLevavos is also available in English. When the Brisker Rav got married, the Brisker Rav had a huge, huge dowry that could have easily supported him the rest of his life learning Torah. All of it was lost. All of it was lost to a fraud. In fact, somebody literally, his real estate agent essentially just stole the property. The Brisker Rav could have had him arrested, but the Brisker Rav didn't want to take a fellow Jew into a secular system. He lost everything. And he was really heartbroken. Imamish was impoverished. He was destitute. But he locked himself into a room and he learned the Shar HaBitachon many times. And he said this was a treasure much more valuable than $1 million. Or whatever it is. There are also more modern svarim that talk about the bitachon. Bitachon is maybe the Vilna Gaon says in Mishlei that the whole purpose of all of our learning and all of our mitzvahs is that we should have bitachon in Hashem. There is nothing that is as important as bitachon. But the way you acquire it is everyone is working on it, but by trying to look in your life, what are you grateful for, to learn to be grateful to Hashem, to see the good. We're so used to things being our way that if things are not our way 100%, we feel bitter. But if one cultivates a midah in which I am grateful for being able to breathe, being able to walk, being able to see, when you say the brachos over an apple, to thank Hashem for an apple or a glass of water, the more you become a person that is makir tova, the more you'll grow in your bitachon. Now, the specific issue about having bitachon when you're sitting around learning, when bombs are bursting over your head, that's really a separate issue, because the halacha is very, very clear that even if I am a 100% boteach in Hashem, I am mechuyev to take what are the normal precautions that people take in times of danger. One generally does not cross against a red light, particularly in Israel, thinking that the car will certainly stop because I have bitachon. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to deliberately put yourself in a dangerous sakana without taking what are called normal precautions. Now, the most difficult question in bitachon, and this is a big question about sakanas, about parnasa, is, okay, I'm not going to get money unless I make some ishtadlis to get money. Right? I'm not allowed to put myself in a dangerous place unless I take some ishtadlis to protect myself against the danger, knowing everything depends on God. Okay. But what is called normal hishtadlus and what is called too much hishtadlus, that is a contradiction to emunah and bitachon. That is a great question. That is really the most difficult question. There were gedolim who said they'll buy one lottery ticket a week and that will be their hishtadlus. And then Hashem will take care of their parnasa one way or the other. Others, you know, work 8 hours a day or more. But the point is this. I will give you a very simple test, at least in the negative sense. If your hishtadlus does not leave you time to daven b'tzibur and to learn every day, then it's too much hishtadlus, by definition. Now, that doesn't mean if you can learn every day, it can still be too much hishtadlus. But if you're crossing into a type of life where your learning is shot and your tefillah is shot, then that's not the hishtadlus Hashem wants you to do. That's almost by definition. But you should give a look at the Chavos HaLevavos. That really is the great classic I'm talking about.
I have a question about Yutas Kislev.
About?
Yutas Kislev?
Yeah. Ah, yeah.
Many Hasidim. I don't know, though. That's Kashat. It's only Chabad Hasidim say it's Rosh Hashanah Hasidim, or all Hasidim. And the Litvish people say Has V'Shalom is Bal Toysiv. They're only for Modim, for Rosh Hashanah, for Five Rosh Hashanah. Do not say anything, though.
Well,
can you restate the question?
Here in Or Sameach, we don't fight with anybody. Today is the 21st of Kislev, right? So, So 2 days ago was the 19th of Kislev. Very important day in Chabad. The 19th of Kislev is called the Rosh Hashanah of Chassidus. Now, what happened was that this is the anniversary. The Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad, Rav Shneur Zalman, who is a great, great Gadol B'Torah, there's no one can dispute that, was imprisoned in Tsarist Russia for a variety of charges, primarily because he was accused of being disloyal to the Tsar, which was absolutely not the case, because if anything, he supported the Tsar against Napoleon, but for whatever reason. And he was exonerated of all charges. He was released on the 19th of Kislev. Now, the way Chabad interprets it is this. They interpret this as a very cosmic struggle, because the Alter Rebbe was being mefarsame. He's called the Alter Rebbe. The old Rebbe, because the founder, he was being mefarsame Kabbalistic teachings to the Hamonam. He was spreading Chassidus. The Midas HaDin wanted to stop him. And what was going on in Shemayim is a struggle between the different forces. Some forces say he should be allowed to teach this, and some were holding him back, and it was going back and forth. He could have been killed. And finally, the Din in Shemayim was that he should be mefarsame his teachings, and therefore they look at the freeing of the Alter Rebbe as the idea that it is a siman min hashamayim that he can and must be mefarsame his chassidus. So they call it the Rosh Hashanah of Chassidus. Now the truth of the matter is, it is only Chabad that calls it Rosh Hashanah of Chassidus, because other chassidus say...
Why is it not the Yatzot of the Mezach Shemagit?
Huh?
This is not the Yatzot of the Mezach Shemagit also.
You know, I don't remember. Is it? Okay, yeah. but that's not... Well, yeah, okay, well, that's...
That's why I know that other Hasidim,
okay.
All the same.
Well, maybe they celebrate... but they don't call it Rosh Hashanah of Chassidus. I mean, maybe they celebrate the Yahrzeit site, but Chabad doesn't make a big deal of the Yahrzeit site. They make a deal of the Alter Rebbe being free. Now, there's a cute story. When the Alter Rebbe was freed from Tsarist prison in Petersburg, that was the Tsarist capital, St. Petersburg it was called. So he was, I'm going to make up a name, he was supposed to be released into the custody of a name, let's call him Goldberg. There was supposed to be a Chabad Chassid Goldberg. So instead, the secret police knew of a Goldberg, but it wasn't the same Goldberg. They released the Alter Rebbe to the custody of another Goldberg, who was a very strong misnaget who hated Chassidus. And it took around 6 or 7 hours till the Chassidische Goldberg picked up the Alter Rebbe. So for 6 or 7 hours, the Alter Rebbe is being harangued about you deserve what you got, and you know you're lucky they didn't kill you. And he's, you know, so the Alter Rebbe said afterwards, he says, you know, that was a lot worse than being in prison. Those 7 hours. So maybe I don't know. Maybe Chabad is celebrating the release from Goldberg's house. I don't know. what it is. But you'll notice that they don't call it the Rosh Hashanah of Chabad. They call it the Rosh Hashanah of Chassidus, because, again, the Chabad Shita is that the Alter Rebbe is essentially the true successor to the Magid of Mezerich, who was the Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov, and therefore the Chassidus of teaching should come into the world through that particular form. Now, to call it Baal Taisif, I wouldn't call it Baal Taisif. I mean, nobody's, I mean, as far as I know, they're not making it like a new Yom Tov. It's a festive day that's very important to the history of their Hasidus, and I think it's legitimate. I think it's something that they should No, they should celebrate. They're not saying it's a Torah commandment. They're not saying it's a rabbinic commandment. So I wouldn't call it. I wouldn't call it Bal Teisa. I think that's a little strong. And again, I do want to emphasize that although Chabad has many, many controversies, and we've discussed them before, and we'll probably discuss them in the future too. But the one thing that everybody's my days, you know, the Alter Rebbe, the Bala Tanya, was a great, great Gadol B'Torah. The Shulchan Aruch Harav that he wrote. A version of the Shulchan Aruch to incorporate is considered to be an authoritative, absolutely authoritative source of psak among everybody, among Hasidim and non-Hasidim. And the Mishnah Berurah will often quote him. Now, Mishnah Berurah may not always paskin like him, but he's always quoted with great respect. So he was truly a great Gadol B'Torah, and he was also one of the greatest Mekubalim. All of the Hasidic Rebbes, even if they're not Chabad, they always acknowledge Rav Shneur Zalman as one of the great, great Gedolim of Kabbalah. Yeah.
And with the four Tanoim going into the orchard in Parbeis, when it says that two of them lost their minds, what does that mean? And if you could give a little background on that story.
Yeah, this is actually a famous Gemara in Chagiga, Maseches Chagiga. There's a whole section in Maseches Chagiga that talks about what is called Maaseh Bereishis, the secrets of God creating the world, and Maaseh Merkava, the secrets of the divine chariot, the Kisei HaKavod. We would identify as what's later called Kabbalah or Sisrei Torah, the secrets of the Torah. And it talks about the fact that this is not for most people to learn, and even if you're worthy of learning this, but it should only be on a one-to-one basis, it shouldn't be in a class, because maybe someone's mind will wander and the world will get destroyed because he has a misunderstanding of these fundamental secrets. So to show how powerful this knowledge is and how dangerous it is if it's misunderstood, so the Gemara gives a story, it's a braisa, of four great, great rabbis who entered the Pardes. Now Pardes literally means an orchard or a garden. And it's a metaphor for entering the heavenly realms where they're getting a sense of the Shechina and the Kisei HaKavod and the chariot. It's all described in the book of Yecheskel, actually, but you know, in very vague terms. So it mentions that one of them became an apostate. He became a heretic. He denied God by that encounter. Another person left his mind, which seems to mean he got crazy. A third person died, and only Rabbi Akiva, Nichnas b'shalom, he entered in peace, and he left b'shalom. So it doesn't say two of them lost their mind. Well, I guess one who became a heretic, you could say lost his mind, but one became an apikoris, one lost his mind. Now, lost his mind probably just literally means he had a mental breakdown. He became crazy, because the concept is that when you're exposed to the ultimate divine light, you have no way of living in this physical world anymore. You can't live in this. Your mind has been exposed to something that you're no longer able to go back to physical reality. It's like it shocks your system. It disorients you so much that you can't see anything. Because you have to understand, if you could have like an MRI, a spiritual MRI of the universe, we would all go crazy. Because it's like God's will and God's essence is pumping through us all the time, keeping everything alive. And if that essence would leave, everything would just disappear. And if a person has that hyper awareness of Hashem in every molecule of his being, it's almost impossible to go on. In fact, this is actually the metaphor. The reason why, in fact, this is from the Balas Tanya, the Alter Rebbe. The Alter Rebbe says that the reason why Hashem conceals his presence in this world is because otherwise we could not exist as independent beings. We would be like a candle absorbed by the sun. And therefore Hashem conceals himself so that we can function. So when you have a person who comes in contact with that higher reality, and he sees the glory of Hashem, and even that would only be partial, but he sees much more than a human being normally sees, he can no longer function in the world. So he had a mental breakdown. He could no longer live in the world that way. So what is the Gemara telling you with this? The Gemara is telling you that not for us to fool around with. You know, Aryeh Kaplan, Zichrono Livracha, was a Mekubal. He was a great person. He was a Mekubal. He wrote on meditation and Kabbalah and the like. And he talks about certain meditative practices on the shame of Hashem. And he says, like going swimming, you should never do this alone. You have to have a buddy in the room who can bring you back to earth. Because, again, these are hard to understand. Because what happens is that as you meditate on Hashem's name, it is possible that your neshama will have such an overwhelming desire to connect to God that you will have an out-of-body experience. Your soul will leave your body and won't want to come back. But you're not supposed to do that. It's called suicide. So you need somebody to kind of slap you in the face, you know, to prevent you from going there. This is what he said. This is not a joke. I mean, this is quite serious. Now, for many people, if they're not attuned to that realm, it's not going to happen to them. But for some people, it may happen. You can die. It's not an accident. Now, my totally unfounded speculation, I have no proof of this at all, but you know that Rabbi Kaplan died very young. And I have a gut feeling, it's only a gut feeling, maybe I shouldn't even say it, is that it was connected to this. That he was very, very deep into this type of contemplative thoughts. And I think that's what happened. Just a guess, but it happens. We have a history of great Mekubalim dying young. The Arizal, of course, died at 39. You're not even supposed to learn Kabbalah until you're 40. Arizal died at 39. Rav Moshe Cordovero died at 40. The Ramchal died around that, a little older, but 45 or so. So the great Mekubalim, Ramchal was a tremendous Mekubal. So the great Mekubalim, as they come in contact with the divinity of Hashem, their neshama can no longer stay in the body.
How did Rabbi Akiva take it?
So this was the greatness of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, you'll notice the Gemara says a very interesting lashon. It says Rabbi Akiva entered in shalom and he left in shalom. The Mefarshim ask, entering in shalom is the chara superfluous. I mean, because we're not questioning what they were when they entered. We just are concerned with how they left. So why does it emphasize nichnas b'shalom? The answer is pashut, that shalom, which is peace, also means perfection and completeness. That before he encountered this, he fortified himself with Torah learning and mitzvot. That created his foundation. That created the ability to take all of this. Right? And that is why we taka say, one should not delve into the mysteries of Kabbalah until you have mastered shas and poskim and the Torah and you're married. So that part of yourself is taken care of, and you're grounded, and then you're ready to go, because you're walking into a hurricane, a tornado. You're walking into something that can really knock you off your feet, totally, unless you're really, really rooted and hold on. Okay, so again, these are realms that, you know, not having not experienced it, I can't give you an eyewitness account of it. But that is what is being described. This is powerful, heady stuff. Now, having said that, let me just point out that if you learn a Chassidish Avort, or you learn even a passage in the Zohar, nothing's going to happen to you. In other words, we can... That type of occasional little bit of taste of this world is something that many say is very good for us. It helps us, it inspires us. It opens up our heart. It gives us a sense of Kedusha. And that is good. That is not what we're talking about. Here we're talking about the heavy-duty meditations that could take hours and hours and hours. That is dangerous. That is potentially dangerous stuff. Okay?
I was wondering if the Rav could tell us, in combination with his legal expertise, how to view the Jonathan Pollard case and his release recently also.
Yeah, well, my legal expertise has been vanishing for a while, but the thing is, you know, somebody asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach many, many years ago. I mean, it's been 25 years ago. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has not been alive for many years. whether getting Pollard out should be treated as pidyon shavuyim, redeeming captives. Do you remember? Redeeming a captive. If somebody is kidnapped, to get them out of captivity is the highest mitzvah. You know, you can sell a Sefer Torah to raise money to redeem captives. So somebody said, Jonathan Pollard is a captive. He's being held in prison. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, no, not true. He says, a captive is somebody who is simply kidnapped, a hostage, someone who is kidnapped for no reason. If somebody commits a crime and they go to jail, we try to help them. Of course we try to help them, but that's not shavuyin because he's supposed to be in prison. But the thing is this, when Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said this, Pollard was in prison maybe three or four years. And again, I think there is a concept that people should pay for their crimes. I mean, we try to give them a defense, but the world is not hefker, and it is proper that people don't commit crimes. But anyone who looks at this objectively would have to say that 30 years for giving some information to Israel, when people who spy against the United States for Russia get less than that and get out before that, can only be chalked up to absolute hatred of the Jewish people. What happened to Jonathan Pollard was an awful, awful thing. It was a tragedy. And Baruch Hashem, I hope, even now, he's such a dangerous security risk, he's not allowed to go to Israel. Which is idiotic, because whatever information he has is more than 30 years old. And, you know, it's not nogay anymore. So, on one hand, you know, spying is not good, and one has to obey the laws of the land, and even to spy for Eretz Yisrael, you know, if you're given classified information from the United States government, is normally not right. But this was a sentence that I think anybody objectively would look at it as Sinas Yisrael, and it's an example of what the Gemara says. Halacha means it's an established law that Esav hates Yaakov. And although the United States, by and large, is a benign country, but there are going to be times when this is going to pop up. And I think this is an example of hatred, of a sinas chinam for Am Yisrael, which was totally, totally... Now again, we have to hope that this is a kapara, both for Pollard and a kapara for, in part, for the generation. And it should have a part in bringing the Mashiach and bringing the Geula. But it was an awful, awful injustice that he should be treated this way. It just wasn't, you know... The punishment does not fit the crime in any meaningful sense. I mean, you can look at spies who did many, many times worse. I mean, it's an amazing thing. You know, to go back many, many years before you were born, before I was born, the only spies, American spies, who have ever been executed, killed, happens to also be a Jewish couple. That's the famous Rosenbergs, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. They got executed Friday night, of all things, you know, Shabbos, to kind of, you know. And once again, there were a lot of bad people who did a lot of bad things, and they didn't get the death penalty. It was only the Rosenbergs to get the death penalty, and Jonathan Pollard gets 30 years in virtual solitary confinement for reporting information to a friendly ally that the U.S. was supposed to turn over. Now, I don't want to get too much political. I mean, through this, Israel botched up as well. You know, he was actually in the Israeli embassy. And legally, if you're in an embassy, it's like you're in the foreign country. You know, the United States, the FBI cannot go into an embassy to arrest you. He was safe, and the Israeli embassy kicked him out. Kicked him out of the embassy in Washington, D.C., right into the hands of the FBI. And then you have a system where he had a plea bargain, where he confessed to doing something with the understanding he would get a light sentence. He confesses, and then he gets a life sentence. I mean, the government lie. So there's so many, you know, bad things here. But again, as I say, Baruch Hashem, he's free, and we hope that that should be a kapara for all of us. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, because in Torah, there's like times where we personify inanimate objects, like the moon complains to Hashem. The rocks around and Jacob lays his head over.
Yeah.
What do we want to understand from these?
Well, this is a hard idea. Now, the way the Mekubalim explain it, they actually say everything has a soul. Rocks have souls. Animals have souls. Plants have souls. Now, the soul of a plant or the soul of a rock is not the same, right? The soul of a rock is not the same as the soul of a plant, and that's not the same as the soul of an animal, and that's not the same as the soul of the human being. But there is a divine spiritual force that somehow communicates with Hashem on some level. Therefore, you have to understand that these dialogues of the inanimate are really discussions of the spiritual force within, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But you know, it's hard for us to understand because this is not anything that we sense. Maybe we sense it in animals to some degree because animals respond, but we certainly do not sense any soul in an inanimate object. But according to the Mekubalim, everything has some type of soul because that is the divine essence that keeps things in existence. Without a divine essence, nothing can exist. So even the inanimate, which is called the domain, has some essence in there, which is the essence, an essence of God. But you know, I don't know if we can do much more than its spiritual essence has some way of dialoguing and communicating with Hashem. That's an expression of will, but it's not the physical rock itself that has the will. It's the essence of the rock. Yeah.
I saw a story of the Sma that he was towing once in Beis Din, and the Beis Din showed him a psak that he had previously given that went against his time.
Yes, yes.
And he admitted that he.
Yep.
How do we understand that story? It's somewhat related is when. How do we understand it if the gadol is closer in a psak or?
Yeah. Did you hear the story with the Sma? Because I heard it with the Shach. I don't know.
So there might be one with the Shach, but I saw okay. it in a true Ksav Sofer.
Okay. Yeah, well, I don't know if it's a different story or the same story. This is like the Sma or the Shach, but it makes no difference for our purposes, wrote one of the great, both of them wrote the greatest commentaries on Choshen Mishpat, which is the part of the Shulchan Aruch dealing with monetary matters. So the story goes that one of those two once had a din Torah. He was suing somebody, and he presented beautiful, intricate arguments with Gemara, Rishonim, to prove that he was right. And everybody thought for sure he'll win because he brilliantly showed how all the sources support him. But the Beis Din then ruled against him. When he asked, "How would you rule against me?" they said, "Well, you had convinced us, but then we saw the commentary you wrote, in which you yourself demolished all of the arguments and said the other side was right." So what the Shach or the Sma said on that is that you see from here the idea of bribery, that objectively you see the truth a certain way, but when it's relevant to you, when it's your own case, you see it very differently. And it's ad kedei kach that I wasn't even aware of my own arguments when it came to me. I saw it the other way. And this is the power of not being a nogeya bedavor. If you have a personal interest, your judgment is tainted. You're not going to see things right. You're going to not that you consciously want to be dishonest. We're not talking about that. The Shach certainly thought he was going li'amito shel Torah. But when you have a personal interest, your judgment gets blinded. And that's a very, very important lesson. That is why you don't judge your own case, right? That is why you cannot be a judge or a witness if you have a negias bedavar. Not because you're going to deliberately lie. We're not afraid people are going to deliberately, some people do lie sometimes, but people are not going to deliberately lie. But you will literally see things differently. And in fact, what might happen is the opposite. And if you bend over backwards not to see things your way, that's going to be a distortion too. Because you might overcompensate by bedavka looking at it the other way, when in fact the reality is somewhere in the middle, or maybe you're right. How do you tell? If I think I'm right, maybe it's because I benefit. And if I think I'm wrong, maybe it's because I'm overcompensating in order not to benefit. That's not MS either. So you need something objective. Right, that's the lesson of that story. And indeed, I heard that the Shach himself would tell over that story in order to emphasize the power of not being a nogeya bedavar. Now, your second question is when a gadol changes his... you know, that's fine. Again, that's not necessarily connected to that story, because I think that story is about negias. But Gedolim can change their position. Once again, the sign of a person who is an Ish Emes is you don't simply stay with something because that's what you paskin before. The Gemara itself says, Amotanam and Amaroim were choser. The Gemara has machloksim between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, where Beis Hillel was choser to paskin like Beis Shammai. And the Gemara says that's a very admirable midah, to be the midah of Moda Lo Emes. I'll tell you a little funny story. There was a professor, I think he happened to be Jewish, but it's not a religious Jew. There was a great professor of psychology, philosophy, in Yale, and he was getting old. He was in his 70s, 80s, and students were complaining that he was contradicting himself. You know, he said one thing on Monday and another thing on Tuesday, so they thought he was getting senile. So the dean called him in to talk about retirement, and this person said, I rethink my philosophy every single day. So yesterday I came to that maskana, today I'm a different maskana. That's weakness, that's a sign of strength. Okay, maybe he was trying to justify what he's doing. But a posek, a gadol, to rethink, to relearn, to go over, is a good thing. And if sometimes you're choser, so you're something. The Rambam was choser, Rashi was choser, modern poskim are sometimes choser. That's perfectly okay. What can I tell you? Now, Lamaisa, if I follow the psak of a posek, and then he's choser later, that doesn't mean I committed a sin. At that time, that was a valid psak. In fact, one could even argue, if I follow the posek after he's choser, it's still a valid psak. Because like this, let's say Rebbe Yoshev paskined a certain way. Okay? And then he was choser. I'm not aware of Rebbe Yoshev himself being choser, but I'm just using an example. Even if he's choser, that means he doesn't hold that way anymore. But that's still a psak that somebody could, if they go through the sources, they could come to that same conclusion, right? So even a chazara does not invalidate a psak. But generally speaking, this is called moda alo emes, and this is a very, very valuable attribute. To give you an analogous example, it's not the same thing. When Shlomo Zalman Orbach was an avrich, a young married man, needed a job. So he tried out to be a Magid Shir, to be Rosh Hashiva in Kol Torah. Kol Torah, yeah. That's his yeshiva. That's where he became Rosh Hashiva. And he gave a shir in front of the elder Rosh Yeshiva. And one of the elder Rosh Yeshivas asked him a kasha in the middle of the shir. And apparently it was a very strong kasha. And Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach said, "You're right, this slugs up my shir. I can't go on." And he stopped. And he went home, and he was very despondent because he really needed the parnasa, he needed the position. And he said, "I blew it." Now he told his Rebbetzin, I could have answered the question, but the answer wouldn't have been emes. Sometimes you can get your way out of a question, but it's not really true. The questioner is really right. So he says, "I wasn't going to fake my way out of it." But he says to his Rebbetzin, "But it's chaval that I lost the position." So the next day they offered him the job, because they said, any person who in the middle of the shir is willing to say he's wrong, that bedafka is the person we want as a Rebbe and a Rosh Hashiva. Because that person takes emes as the highest quality. If he would try to defend himself when it was clear that he was not correct, that would have been an evus, that would have been a perversion of emes. That would have been an undesirable quality. So that notion of being Madar Lemes is a very, very important one. Yeah?
I was wondering, the Rav said earlier that, like you mentioned, Misa Hasharim and how the Ram calls him Kubal and everybody
yep.
says that and everything.
Yep.
I was just wondering, the simple reading of Misa Hasharim is not going to give you anything.
That's correct.
It seems like it. And it says that...
I mean, I'm not going to give you a Kabbalah. It'll give you plenty.
Right. Kabbalah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can you give some examples of, like, some deeper things?
Well, first of all, I guess. First of all, Misil Shasharim is not the only work the Ramchal wrote. I mean, if you take Derech Hashem. Derech Hashem is 100% based on Kabbalah, but without Kabbalistic terminology. This is Kabbalah written in lay person's terms. The Ramchal has maybe 20, 25 other svarim, which are heavy Kabbalah.
So there's not much Kabbalah. It's not based on that.
What, Misil Shasharim? It's absolutely based on Kabbalah. But the Ramchal had a very unusual talent. The Ramchal had a talent. Most people that are Mekubalim, they think and they talk in the language of Kabbalah. The language of Kabbalah is very, very difficult to even understand. What are they referring to? It's a symbolic language. It refers to different dimensions of reality. And if you're not attuned to the system, you don't even understand the words that are being used. The Ramchal had such a deep understanding of Kabbalah that he could translate it into concepts that a child could understand on some level. So a work like Mesilas Yesharim is based on Kabbalah too, but without any Kabbalistic language, without any Kabbalistic concepts, but it's at least based and it's attuned to the Kabbalistic worldview, you know. But all I can tell you is that in order to really see how this is so, I'll give you a simple example. When the Ramchal says, even this idea that everybody's heard a million times, that God created the world to give us pleasure, and if he were to give us pleasure without our earning it, it would be the bread of embarrassment and humiliation, and therefore he has to create a world where we struggle so we become worthy of the reward, and then the reward is a true reward because it does not have any shame or humiliation. Right? I'm sure everyone here has learned that idea of Nahama de Kisufa, the bread of shame. That's straight from the Arizal. That's Kabbalah. That's Kabbalah. But it's been a mainstreamed idea. The Ramchal mainstreamed many Kabbalistic ideas, that the world was created so that God could give us pleasure. Right? So, and there are, you know, other examples as well. Yeah.
Going on the topic of MS and pursuing MS.
Yeah.
Does that conflict at all with the idea of like judging someone favorably? And like, for instance, like, say you see someone doing something that you think might be wrong, you might be able to think of how it could be something positive. Not that going for MS would like exclude the possibility of judging favorably, but let's say you think from a probability standpoint that it's more likely they did something wrong.
Yeah, so I think the answer is that Hashem doesn't want us to delve into every emes that exists in the world. Meaning to say like this, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us we have to learn Torah, we have to do mitzvahs. So memela, what we have to look into, we have to take the midah of emes. But Hashem doesn't say we have to look into everything. I don't have to look into what this guy did, and therefore I judge him l'kaf sechus. Now, if it was relevant, for example, if it came up as a shidduch, if it's my own child and I need to know because of chinuch, then indeed emes may take precedence over judging with kafshchutz, right? You know, if your sister or your daughter is married to a guy and you hear all sorts of bad things about the guy, you don't say, "Oh, go ahead and marry him and judge the kafshchutz," and you have to investigate, right? So I would just say that those things which Hashem or Halacha tells you to look into, you look at the midah of emes, but there's a lot of things that, you know, we don't have to look into. I don't have to know, and therefore I judge the person favorably. By the way, one other point I want to make, just as an aside, you mentioned judging the kaf sechus. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says a gewaldige explanation of this term. Most of us understand judging the kaf sechus as I give you the benefit of the doubt. So I see you going into a treif restaurant. I assume you're using the bathroom, or you're using the payphone when they used to not have cell phones, or you want a glass of water. Now, sometimes that is a stira to emes. I kind of know why you're going in. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz gave a whole other explanation. Judging l'kaf sechus doesn't just mean giving people the benefit of the doubt, but it means that in every action a person does, there is good aspects and bad aspects. Meaning to say, even if I'm violating the Torah, but it may come because of pressures that people hurt me. In other words, it basically means you try to focus on the good within a person even when they're doing bad. And if they're doing good, you don't focus on the negatives in their mitzvahs. A person can be doing mitzvahs negatively too, l'shem kavod. And therefore, judging l'kaf sechus is not naivete, but it's the empathy and compassion of trying to see the good in a person even when he has chesronos. So that's not a steer to emes. If anything, that's a truer emes. Because in every person there is good and bad, and you strive to see the good. He explains this because there's a brisa in Avest Rabbi Nassan that says that if you judge people l'kaf sechus, Hashem will judge you l'kaf sechus. Now, if you interpret l'kaf sechus in the conventional way, that makes no sense. Meaning, if I see you go into a McDonald's, a Treif McDonald's, and I say you're going in for kosher, so when I go into a Treif McDonald's, Hashem will judge me favorably. Well, not if I'm eating Treif. In other words, it's not possible to say God will give me the benefit of the doubt, because Hashem has no doubt. So what's the sense? If I judge you, l'kaf sechus, Hashem will judge me, l'kaf sechus. But, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, if we understand l'kaf sechus, not as being ignorant of what the guy is doing, but that even if the guy does it, I try to see the good in him in other ways, then Hashem will judge me that same way. Then it makes perfect sense, you see? So that's a very excellent raya. Okay, one more question. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just wondering, based on what you said about Shidduchim, that a person, like, it's not Lashonara and everything, why would, based on the Rashi in last week's Parsha, that it says that Yaakov was punished for hiding Dina from Esav.
Yep.
So why was he punished? Or Esav was a Rashi, not even Lashonara
nothing. Yeah, this is a very, very excellent question. Remember, everyone knows the Rashi that the reason why Dina was kidnapped and raped is because Yaakov, the Lashon of the Medrash is, put Dina in a box. So because he didn't want his brother Esav to marry Dina, and Yaakov is punished and Dina suffers because Yaakov withheld her from Esav. And the question is very obvious. I'm supposed to give my daughter to somebody that is a Rasha and a Rotseach and a murderer? Yaakov is condemned because he didn't allow such a shidduch? That's what a father is, that's what a parent is supposed to do. You protect your child from such a shit. So it's a very, very excellent question. So there are two answers that are given. One is that, and again, this would Badavka not be applied in our everyday life, that Dina was such a tzaddikus that she could have changed Esav. Now, I wouldn't say you can make that judgment about our own daughters, but Yaakov was in a position to know. Dina could have changed him. And if Yaakov doesn't allow that to happen, Yaakov is an achroi for the transformative effect that Dina could have had. The other answer that's given, what does the Alter Slobodka say? He said it in kind of a funny way. He said, Yaakov was right in what he did, but he didn't have to nail the box so tight. Meaning to say, there was a certain joyful glee, on some level, that Yaakov had, he's a bum. In other words, they're kind of like a personal satisfaction in not giving Esav this gift. And that was not right. That even if you have to be Moneya Dina because the brothers are Russia, you don't take a personal pleasure in that. Now, this was very subtle, but Hashem, who looks at every nuance of the heart, so Yaakov was guilty, not for what he did, but for the pleasure that he got in it. And this is called getting pleasure through the humiliation or hurt of another person. There's actually a word that's used in English, a German word, Schadenfreude, such a phrase. That means mischabed beklon chaveiro. That actually means getting joy in the downfall of another, and that is improper, even in the case of Esav. Okay, have a good.